The next case is 96-1074, Gerald Vance, deceased, versus Wesley Trimble. Mr. DeRose. You may take your visitor badge off if you'd like, Mr. DeRose. You don't need to. Thank you. How much? Yeah, watch your time there.
This appeal presents a case of first impression in the area of workers' compensation, as well as presenting some distasteful, some reprehensible, and definitely politically incorrect facts. I'll get it right out in the open. My client died as a result of taking DARSA N100 far in excess of what was prescribed. He suffered an injury on August 3rd, 1991.
And mixing it with alcohol.
Yes, there was indication that he had had some alcohol, but there was testimony by the toxicologist and even by the defense toxicologist that the alcohol was not the proximate cause of his death, and that the clear result of his dying was as a result of toxicine, which is the active agent in DARSA.
Didn't that toxicology report indicate that he had to take much more of the medication than was prescribed?
Yes.
Didn't that very high reading show up in his...
Yes, the evidence indicates it was somewhere between costs around 14 pills and 46
and
hours.
Instead, he was prescribed to take one every 3 to 4 hours.
Correct. And that's why I open the fact that the issue is the gentleman took too many pills, but the problem is then with the trial court and the court of appeals is that they're equating the overdose with the death. Sometimes the society makes those two words synonymous. The trial court, as well as the court of appeals, precluded my claimant from receiving benefits under 4123-46 and 4123-54B, which sets out the purposely self-inflicted standard for
was there any evidence, I couldn't really find it, but was there any evidence put out by the other side that he was suicidal or he wanted to end his life in any form or fashion? Or was this merely someone who was over-medicating and that's where your attention comes in?
Exactly. This is a case of over-medication. All parties agree that this was not a suicide. That was in the coroner's report. There was no indication of suicide. And that is why one of the reasons we find fault with the Court of Appeals' rationale for affirming this, the summary judgment. This is not a suicide. When you look at the purpose of self-inflicted statute, you have to look at resolving harm. And in a death case.
So our issue really then becomes, there's probably not much dispute that he deliberately took that thing. He couldn't really take them accidentally. I don't think we can argue that.
No.
So it's a question of by deliberately taking the pill, did he intend the harm, and is that harm compensable? That's the part of the issue.
Exactly. The case law, in this case, when you're looking at purposely self-inflicted, you have to look at it in two parts. You intend the action, and you also intend the resulting harm. And in this case, the resulting harm is his death, and it's really, knowing self-inflicted death is you're intending your death at a suicide, and everybody admits that this gentleman did not commit suicide. So just based on the facts on your face, they do not fit the case law in Drips and Malone that were in 1953 that were confirmed by Zarnecki in 1979.
Isn't there also a problem here, aside from that, with relating this death to the deceased job? I can't believe the General Assembly would have intended that that an employer be, or that the fund pay compensation to a person, or here the estate of a person who has a fairly minor injury at work and overindulges in beer or alcohol and drugs, and whether he intends to die or not, it seems to me isn't that way out of the scope of employment?
It's not out of the scope of employment, so long as you have a causal connection between the injury, which was not in and of itself a minor injury. This gentleman had surgery to the area just on July 6th, and it was hurt August 3rd in an accident, how he hit it. He hit a truck pole with a suicide knob on a tractor that smacked the surgical site. And it was painful enough, the doctor paying a night to prescribe, the doctor said he threw him off of work. Our position is this, basically proximate cause is a continuing sequence of events that are related to each other. There is not one instance, one happened. So he was hurt with an injury. He was prescribed medication for that injury with pain. He had a low threshold for pain and tended to self-medicate himself. And as a result of self-medication, he took the excess dosage and died. Now, if you're looking at it just as an overdose and a death, you get back to that, equating the word overdose with his death. Now, did he intend to overdose? Well, if he intended to overdose, you have to look at why he intended to take the pills. Now, if we're looking at the word overdose and equating it with taking one's life, if he intended to take his life, then no, it's not compensable. But if he intended to take the medication, you look at why he intended to take the medication, but the fact he had the injuries, he might even be taking this medication.
But
he was taking it to
the
pain.
The Court of Appeals, there's a concurrence by one of the judges of the Court of Appeals who says, you know, that he would buy your argument, but he doesn't buy it here, where someone over has a low threshold of pain. I think that Judge Tyack was saying, I might buy the argument, but when you get to 20, you know, at some point the quantity of additional medication takes this out of the area of compensability.
Judge Tyack, that was correct. It was Judge Tyack. Well, we have to remember this is an issue on summary judgment. And it is the kind of condition that when you are looking at this, this is a jury question.
Well, the summary judgment, we have it for a reason. And we do, in this state, have agreed that there are cases that no reasonable minds could not disagree about some things. And I think that Tyack's point was reasonable minds could not disagree about somebody taking 20 pills when there's a warning. I guess that's where he got to. He thought, I might go with the theory, but at the quantity here precludes me from buying it.
In workers' compensation, the intelligence of my client should not be held against him. What he knew about these pills. There is testimony in there that Darvis said, although being a painkiller is slow to effectuate its response. And now,
summary judgment is based on objective, not subjective. Objective, a reasonable person could not disagree. So it's not your client. Is it a your scenario? I guess that's the point.
Yeah, it is.
This particular man couldn't know that 20 pills. You can show that he didn't know 20 pills could be harmful.
Well, basically, we have the testimony of the experts in this case, that we have objective testimony about the length of time it takes for this reaction. We have the testimony of why he was prescribed the medication. We have expert testimony as to why the Dr. Shen testified that he had a low threshold of pain and tended to self-medicate. That is all we were dealing with the scene. That's all the objective evidence in this case that anybody can present in this case. When you're looking, when you're going to apply 4120, the statute of purpose of self-infliction, that goes to state of mind. And without the scene there, that has to be a jury question. There's no way that you're going to have objective evidence of what his state of mind was when he was taking the pills. And for that reason, it has to be a jury question, and under summary judgment, it should have been before the trial of fact.
There has to be a causal connection between the work and the injury or the death. Why would not the ingestion of the alcohol and the drugs be an intervening cause, breaking the causal relationship between the work and the death?
Because under the statute, in order for the drugs or the alcohol to be an intervening cause, the drugs or the alcohol have to be the proximate cause. That is, in the statute, has to be the proximate cause.
And they were.
Well, the alcohol...
He wouldn't have died from his hand.
The alcohol was not... The experts testified the alcohol was not the proximate cause.
Right, but the drugs were.
But see, the possibility was a prescribed drug. We're not talking about a non-prescribed drug. We are talking about a drug that was prescribed for the pain, for the injury he suffered at OSU on August 3rd, 1990. And now it is a matter of self-medication. Did he try to self-medicate?
So if somebody is injured in the course of their employment, and it requires them to be put into traction, and they decided they're not going to use the traction, and they're going to go out and play basketball, and they become a paraplegic because of that. That was a result of the original injury, and therefore, that's not an intervening cause?
Depending on whether he had suffered another separate injury, but closer to it would be a situation where if my client required stitches, and instead of going back to the doctor to have those stitches removed, which most normal people would do, he decides to remove his own stitches and suffers an infection. That infection, because he's self-medicated, is causally connected and is compensable. I would submit that scenario is a little bit closer to what happened here because my client decided that, and we're all subjected and planning on my client what he did that day, but the two wasn't working, four wasn't working. There's a time delay to these drugs, and that is how he ended up where he was. And the causal connection in this case is the overdose in the sense that he took too many pills for a reason, and the reason being that he was suffering pain from his injury and he was self-medicating. It's not a scenario where he decided to just take the pills and bring about his own demise. And even in the state of Ohio, if that was the case, that the courts aren't so quick to say that you're absolutely, it's not compensable, they'll look under the workplace standard to see if there was any causal connection with the work-related injury, or even as an overdose where you're intending to take the life.
Your argument seems to remove from the claimant any responsibility for his own conduct. Does it or does it? Am I wrong assuming that, concluding that? He had 0.16 grams of alcohol. In Ohio, 0.10, you're a drunk driver. And the autopsy report said that the death occurred with significant drug-alcohol interreaction. I'm still having a problem with the causal connection here and the implications in this case if we were to adopt your view to the fund for employees who are injured at work and need to be compensated. It seems to me this is a, I don't want to use the word floodgate, but it would have wide implications beyond what it seems the statute
calls for. It's already in the statute, Your Honor. The statute basically says purposely self-inflicted. That is a state of intent.
No, I'm off the self-inflicted. I don't think you can tell here whether this was self-inflicted, but it seems to me you can conclude as a matter of law on summary judgment that there's no proximate cause here, that this was something he did. He had an injury to his hand, and he decided to drink a lot of alcohol, to take Darvon, and to take, apparently also took Valium and some other things. I'm having the same problem, I guess, as Justice Douglas's question suggested. Where's the proximate cause between the... Sure, he had an injury to his hand, but he did something very significant after he had that injury, which was ingest a whole lot of stuff into his system that killed him.
Our position is basically for a jury to decide. If we decide that, I will grant you.
What's left for a jury to decide here? We have the evidence, don't we? Isn't there sufficient evidence? We have an autopsy report. We have the report of the doctors who says this was his injury. Isn't this now a legal question for us to decide or for the trial court to decide as it did?
Basically, you've removed it from the legal arena in that the first part of what I understand your question to be, you indicated that the floodgate, the fact that this is a reprehensible set of facts, that you took so many pills, is that something that we should compensate in workers' compensation? That is more a public policy than it is a legal argument. And our position is that's for the jury to decide, because the courts up until this point here have decided that this is an egregious set of facts, and they say, well, these can't be contested. If you start to let that happen on a summary judgment basis, where does it stop? What next set of facts comes before the court and says, well, we don't like that set of facts? That is why you have a trier of fact. We have put forth the middle burden of the competition to get to the jury, to get beyond summary judgment. And if trier of fact says that no, this does not fit, then so be it. That's what the system is for. But again, my concern here is that what's the next set of facts that is so that the court or justice needs to be so brief that it can't be compensable. And that is the danger we run here. If we don't let this go to the jury, let the jury decide whether this is compensable or not. Because under the law, a claim of workers' compensation is negligent, gross negligent, wrong. It's all the way up into purposeful. And where the fact of the issue of culpability, that is why the statute is discussed.
Counsel, I may be not as fond of summary judgment as some of my colleagues, but isn't the distinction here for you that purposeful? I'll grant you there seems to be no history that he intended to kill himself. But taking this many, it's pretty hard to say that he didn't intend to cause an intervening injury, but that taking this many was, it's hard to imagine anybody could be that stupid, that he isn't at least has some knowledge that he intends to knock himself out, which he could have done with alcohol alone. Taking pills.
I see my time. May I finish?
Yes.
In response to that, with regard to the stupidity, I'm an active practitioner of workers' comp, and thank God to pay these in defense, or I'd be out of practice in many regards. But the idea is that there is only one resulting harm in this case, and that is his death. However, we're not asking for the deterioration of the stomach lining or anything else that would result out of taking this much medication, but the one resulting harm is death. And we conclude that he did intend the harm, and by the statute, he wasn't purposely self-inflicted. And to piggyback on top of that, we have set out the prima facie case for the causal connection, and it's for the jury to decide whether we've met our burden.
Thank you, Mr. DeRose. Mr. Barnes.
May I please report, Mr. DeRose? I'd like to clarify a few things. First, for Justice Stratton, I agree this is not a suicide case, and all parties have agreed throughout that this is not a suicide case. As such, the girl ties us that whether or not the decedent intended to kill himself is irrelevant in this case.
But would it make any difference if this was a drug dependent person and the doctor went ahead and prescribed this medication for him? Would that make any difference in this case?
I think the issue is whether the act of taking the medication was purposeful. That's the issue. In this case, and I agree with Justices Douglas and Cook and Justice Moore, this is a case of approximate causation, at least in part. There are three reasons as to which the Bureau is entitled to summary judgment. One of those reasons has nothing to do with whether the injury was purposely self-inflicted. afflicted. That reason is that the claimant widow failed to demonstrate approximate causation between the hand injury, the drug overdose, and subsequent death. The chain of causation was broken when the decedent opted to, as you will, deviate. It's a classic deviation case, assuming that the doctor is an extension of the employer. The doctor specifically advised the decedent to do one thing, and as opposed to traveling 1 mile down the road, the decedent traveled 20 miles down the road.
Let me change the facts on that. It's just a deviation case. Say he broke his leg, and they about to put a cast on. The cast itched, and so he took it off instead of waiting 6 weeks that he's supposed to wear it. And it, as a result of that, is disabled for the rest of his life. But for taking the cast off prematurely, this fellow would have been hopping right along and no loss of motion.
That's a much closer issue.
That one gets to the jury.
I believe that probably does get to the jury. However, I think you have to look at the degree of deviation. In this case, the deviation was significant and unreasonable. One does not look at a prescription and it says take one Garbicet every 3 to 4 hours and mistakenly, accidentally read that as taking 20 within that same period of time.
If the pills are not working to alleviate the pain, are you saying just because he went against the doctor's orders that it is that he can't medicate himself more than ordered if the pills aren't working? How do we know whether they're working at all? You're just assuming that they worked and that he just went against the orders and took more than he should have. What if the pain reliever wasn't working for this man? Does he have a right to take 3 or 4 or 5 more than the doctor told him if they're not working?
Well, I'm not assuming anything, Your Honor. In this case, there was no evidence, absolutely no evidence, that the pain medication was not working. There's no evidence that the excessive amount of Garbicet that was being taken was due to the pain.
Isn't that a logical conclusion one can draw from taking more than is prescribed, that it was not working effectively for the person?
No, I don't think that's logical. I think it's logical that a reasonable individual, would abide by the prescription.
You agreed this was not suicide.
We agreed it was not suicide.
So his taking of the pills was not something he wanted to do to kill himself, correct?
We don't know that. So we're assuming that it was not suicide.
You can't agree to something and then go and say if you don't agree. You agreed it's not suicide.
There's no evidence that it's suicide.
Okay. Now, the only other logical conclusion, if you agree it was not suicide, is that the pain that this person was experiencing was greater than maybe the normal person, and the pills that he was prescribed were not working. So in order to alleviate the pain, he took more pills. Isn't that a logical conclusion?
If you make the assumption that he was in pain, which was more than another individual would be in pain, and again, that's an assumption which is not contained within the record.
Everybody has different reactions to pain relievers and many drugs, do they not?
But there's no evidence in the record here that this individual took the drugs as a result of a low threshold of pain. And I think if you make an assumption like that, you're not making a decision based on the facts. The summary judgment motion would be
I think it's a logical assumption to make. If you agree he wasn't committing suicide, it's a logical assumption that he was taking excess pills because they weren't working. If you agree he wasn't committing suicide.
No, I think it would be more logical that if the drugs were not working, that he contact either the doctor who prescribed the drugs or another medical individual to say, these drugs are not working. Is there something else I can
say? Is that a reasonable conclusion to assume?
I think it is.
That just saying, well, these are kind of weak, I'm going to take 3 or 4 more, isn't more logical to assume?
It may be more logical to say I'm going to take 3 or 4 more, but in this case, he took 19 more.
Well, why shouldn't we let
there
seems to be a lot of questions in this case. Why shouldn't we let a jury determine them?
Your Honor, with all due respect, I cannot believe that a jury would find it reasonable that an individual would take 20 times the recommended dosage.
How do you know? Isn't that a question? We're talking about throwing a person's claim out as a matter of law and cutting off their right to a jury determination because of a determination that you feel is correct and my determination isn't.
No, I think a jury of 8 reasonably minded individuals would find that an individual who substantially and unreasonably deviated from prescribed dosage would find that a reasonable jury would find that such a deviation bore no proximate relationship to the initial minor hand injury.
I agree with you. That is a very reasonable and logical conclusion for a jury to determine. Why don't we let them do that?
Well, that's the very purpose of the summary judgment motion, whether a reasonably minded jury could come to that conclusion.
That's one
conclusion the jury could come to.
That's one conclusion that they could come to. And I agree with you, but they also could come to other conclusions because there are so many things that we're really guessing at and that we cannot point to evidence and facts in this case to be certain. There are uncertainties in this case that a jury must be allowed to determine. Are there not?
Well, I think if you present a case like this to the jury, you're asking the jury to speculate. Based on the facts of this case, and we're looking at the facts for purposes of summary judgment, the claimant widow has set forth no evidence.
Do we assume the facts in favor of one party or the other in the summary judgment?
Most favorably, but the claimant has presented no facts.
Most favorably for who?
Most favorably in light of the claimant.
We are to assume all these facts in favor of the person against whom the summary judgment has been filed, correct?
Correct, and the group posits that there are no facts in the widow claimant's favor in this case.
Okay.
There were a number of expert witnesses, depositions, and testimony taken in this case, and none of those witnesses addressed the issue of proximate causation in regards to the initial hand injury, the overdose, and the death. The closest the widow claimant got to a proximate causation opinion was that of Dr. Shintz. And as my brief indicated, that opinion falls woefully short of a proximate causation opinion, which should get to the jury.
How exactly did he put it?
Dr. Schiff indicated that the decedent, because of his dire or significant pain, took the overdose of drugs, which, based on his records, led to death.
And that he had a low threshold for pain?
And that he had a low threshold for pain.
So I thought you told Justice Sweeney there wasn't anything about low threshold of pain in this.
There was no evidence in this case that he took the Darvastatin in question as a result of his low threshold of pain. In this case, Dr. Schiff based his testimony on the fact, on his assumed fact, which was not in evidence, that the claimant was in, I think he termed it rather, it was a rather painful injury. Again, Dr. Schintz never saw this injury. Dr. Schintz saw the decedent 2 months before the alleged injury and death. And then you have to read Dr. Schintz's testimony as a whole, including the cross-examination. cross-examination, you can't just look at the magic words. Magic words don't get you there. So cross-examination...
Well, now, this is summary judgment. What you're relating is the process a jury goes through, right? They're entitled to these facts read in their most favorable light to dodge summary. And it seems to me you want to take these facts and dress them up and say, well, but, you know, when reasonable...
Well, I disagree. I'm not dressing up the facts. The doctor specifically said on page 49-52 of his deposition, I do not know why the decedent took the drugs on August 3rd. I do not know. He also, because he didn't see the decedent on the day of his death, had to accept the findings of the other physicians who may have examined the decedent. The only physician who examined the decedent prior to his death was Dr. Pangalangan. Dr. Pangalangan never testified that this was a rather painful injury. He never testified to that. Dr. Shinz's testimony is based on a fact, not in evidence. That fact being that the decedent was in pain, significant pain. That's not there. A doctor's testimony, the response to a hypothetical question.
Okay,
is not
well, you want to engage in this, what reasonable minds could not conclude. Seeing that they put together enough here, a visible injury, prior surgery or prior injury to the hand that is fairly recent in time, I think most reasonable minds would conclude that probably was a painful injury. I mean, it seems to me it certainly got to that point in terms of dodging. Summary. Are you saying that they didn't even present enough to allow these facts to be read in most favorable light toward them, that there's any evidence that the injury was at all painful?
I'm saying that they are not facts that they relate to this case. They're simply naked allegations.
There's no level of pain that's going to justify a conclusion that it requires 20 of these pills.
But there's no evidence in the record which would indicate that this specific injury placed the decedent in such a degree of pain that a reasonable person would have taken 20 Narcan as opposed to 1 Narcan over 3 to 4 hour period of time.
Is there any evidence that he was drinking the beer because of the pain? Or at what point do we get to the issue of whether this medicine was taken to get high?
The evidence or the record does not establish what point in time he took the alcohol, the unprescribed value, or the prescribed Narcan. What we do know is that it was all done within a 3 to 4 hour period. And that's all we know. There's no indication that the medication, the alcohol, the value was anything other than was taken by any means other than the decedent's own volition. I see that my time is up. Before I have any further questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Barnes. Mr. DeRose, you've used your time, but you may take 30 seconds.
My client spent 2 or 3 hours critical hours by himself in short sales. I can't prove what actually happened in there. The chain of causation that you set out is exfoliative of the injury, which was supported by Dr. Pangalangan in the record. Treatment for that injury by Dr. Pangalangan. As part of the treatment, it was prescribed Darvocet by Dr. Pangalangan. Critically, Dr. Shenz testified that my client had low threshold of pain and tended to self-medicate. His basis was the faculty of personal and professional opinion that he was treating family doctors for
15 years. That's in the record of 48, page 26.
Surely Dr. Shintz should not be taken to say that 1,600 grams of alcohol, two different types of Valium, and 20 of these Darvon things is proper self-medicating to the point that the fund ought to pay for somebody who does that. Should it? I mean,
It's an issue where, is it proper medication? Of course it's not proper medication, but anytime you step away from what the doctor tells you to take is not proper. If this were a case where it didn't happen 4 to 6 hours, but let's say it happened over 2 or 3 years where he took the medication constantly in excess and developed dependence for this, that would be compensable. It just so happened that my client did it all in about 4 hours, because there is competent testimony in there by the experts that this stuff takes time to kick in. What happened in this case, and we put forth the evidence to at least get us to the jury on, is in the first 3 to 4 hours after this injury, this guy was in pain. He had serious surgery on his hand, and when that with the chuck hole, and it spun that suicide knob on him right where he had his surgery, he was in pain. And we have put forth enough evidence to say that 3 or 4 hours, this man was doing whatever it took to get rid of that pain. And we feel that is compensable. And unfortunately, all of a sudden, everything, all you have to repeat and self-medicate kills kicked in, and that's what killed him. We feel that is at least to get to the jury and it should be compensable. Thank you.
Thank you. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All right.